Secondly, because she
And welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet. I'm here in the studio with the late Patty Fink. Laurent Landis took today off so he could be with Gabrielle to do an Easter egg hunt. Patty and I decided, since it's Easter and Passover, we'd both have our pastors on. She was going to bring her pastor, Robert Jeffress, and I brought mine, Rabbi Steve Fish. What?
Oh, well, he couldn't make it. He's probably
busy.
He's fellowshipping, I'm sure.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. I know you tried.
I know. And I tried to get the people from Westboro. Westboro. Right. I tried to get them from Westboro, but they just wouldn't come with me. I even offered to go up and pick them up.
So I guess we're just, you know, you couldn't get your pastor, so we're just not going to be able to do the Easter part of it.
Because she can speak as a pastor.
Have you ever heard her talk about religion? I mean, you know how my questions sometimes are off the wall? Expect Patty's to be today to be genuinely dumb.
David, with his usually benevolent spirit.
Thank you.
We have a Jewish holiday known as Yom Kippur, where we atone for our sins. And David,
it's a one-day holiday. I take a week.
Yeah, that's right.
You need a week.
That's right. But David starts the minute after Yom Kippur is over to be sure that he has something for next year.
Yeah.
And I usually
do. And every day thereafter.
Yep. Well, Rabbi Fish, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming back after the last time. God knows what we did to him that time. But we're going to talk a little bit about Passover and what it is, and a little bit even its relation to Easter and what it means. So, first of all, what is Passover?
Okay. Passover, let's go back to the biblical origin of Passover. Biblical origin of Passover is that really – reading the whole book of Exodus, you know the story of Passover. And I'm sure everyone here has, everyone who is here and who is listening to us at this hour has read the entire book of Exodus. But it's basically let my people go. Mm-hmm. The Hebrew people were slaves in the land of Egypt. They originally were invited in. Joseph, in fact, was Pharaoh's right-hand man. But then the book of Exodus begins as then there arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. And the Hebrews were in, to make a long story short, because I could take the whole hour just reading the book of Exodus. In fact, I have it here on my computer. And, but in essence, Pharaoh enslaves the Jews. The Jews desire freedom after a series of plagues. Pharaoh lets the Jewish people go. The Jewish people leave via the parting of the Sea of Reeds. You've seen Charlton Heston do that. And
in fantabulous technicolor.
That's right. And they go into the desert. I've got to tell you a story. You know, I've got to digress. I'm a rabbi. I happened to be one Easter weekend. It didn't happen to correspond with Passover that year. I don't remember why. But anyway, I was on one of the little trains going, or the trams going around DFW, and Charlton Heston was on there. And Charlton Heston was heading for a tennis tournament. I was the rabbi at that point in Corpus Christi, and I knew Charlton Heston was heading for Corpus Christi. And I said, well, there are going to be two miracles this weekend. First of all, you're parting the Red Sea, and secondly, you're going for a tennis tournament in Corpus Christi. And he says, of course, in his deep, deep bass voice, I know how one of them is going to turn out.
But you have to peel the tennis racket from his cold, dead hands.
I had to. No, I had to get his rifle. He was carrying it at that time. You know, his NRA membership sticker across his front. And anyway, he almost shot me.
Yeah, well. So the Jews shot their way across the Red Sea.
The Jews shot their way across the Red Sea. It was with rocket boosters.
Is that how they made it?
Yeah, that's how they made it.
Okay.
And the Sea of Reeds, by the way, is now the way it's translated, not the Red Sea.
So we don't really know that it was actually the Red Sea, but the Red Sea is that sea that's in between Egypt and the Sinai.
Sinai, right. But there is also a thin sea that is the Sea of Reeds between those places. Mm. And the translation is inexact. We're not sure exactly where it is. In fact, we were talking beforehand. There is no archaeological evidence from Egyptian sources that the Exodus ever happened.
And they kept pretty immaculate records.
Right.
Accurate records of what actually, who they had enslaved, who was working, who built things.
That's right. They had time cards created by IBM, and each slave had to clock in. And unfortunately, you know, we've never been able to find those time cards. We did find a computer tape, but unfortunately, it was written in hieroglyphics, and we couldn't understand it. But the reality is that there's no historical proof or archaeological proof that the Jews were enslaved, or that they actually left Egypt and
trekked back and forth
for 40 years to the Promised Land. But the point is that whether this is a metaphor, whether this is an allegory, or as we suspect, these were folk myths that were passed down from generation to generation of people sitting around the campfire, telling stories of their heroes of the past. Or even whether, and this is a liberal interpretation, at some later time the Jews wrote this story to create this great hero Moses, who was responsible for all the laws of Judaism and all the stories of Judaism. We don't know, and for me as a liberal Jew, it doesn't matter. Orthodox Jews would take the story literally, or do take the story literally. And but for me, it doesn't matter if Moses was a historical figure, if Moses was an allegorical figure, if these things actually happen. What's cool is the fact that as we go farther in the book of Exodus and in the entire Torah, for that matter, principles of morality and ethics are presented that were far before any other people and have influenced humankind ever since.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really matter in Judaism if certain events happened or if these are stories. What's important is the lesson from it.
Correct.
And how you live your life.
Yeah, that's in liberal Judaism, David.
And it's all about don't be E.G. Marshall.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But now, if you had an Orthodox rabbi sitting here, which he wouldn't be unless he walked here on Passover, I'm not going to get into that today. But if you had an Orthodox rabbi sitting here, and in fact, you know, I might hear from one of my Orthodox colleagues later, Orthodox Judaism, which is the most fundamentalist of the Jewish religious groups, would say, yes, everything happened. Moses wrote all this down, and this is exactly as it happened.
And that's fine that that's the belief, but my point is that it doesn't change the faith at all?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
It doesn't change any of the beliefs at all?
No, change none of the beliefs. And as a liberal Jew, I'm very comfortable, regardless of what happened. As a liberal Jew, I'm very comfortable if all these events did occur exactly as they're recorded in the Torah or in the later books of the Bible, the Nevi'im and Ketuvim, the prophets and the writings, known as the Tanakh. I'm very comfortable if they did occur. But if they didn't occur, I'm okay with that also.
All you're really saying is if it occurred, didn't occur, my religion's the same, my faith's the same, my beliefs are the same. It's that would be different for what you grew up with if it didn't happen.
Oh, yeah, if it's not in there. I mean, and in the King James English, you know, that's the way it occurred.
You mean if God said you rather than thou?
Yeah. Yeah,
it would change the whole religion.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing, you know. And for our listeners who don't or maybe new, I'm a recovering Southern Baptist, but I don't attend First Baptist Dallas, which is where our beloved Reverend Jeffress is.
You don't? I thought that's why you were always late. Sometimes the service runs a little bit late.
No, Patty, I know. I saw you in that commercial with all those smiling people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what happened?
Down in front of the fountains and that 6,000 seat. I've got that confused. I'm sorry. That's American Airlines Center.
Pretty darn close.
Okay, so Passover is this weekend and this week. The first two nights are the Seder. What does that mean? What does that have to do with Passover? How is Passover celebrated?
Okay.
That's a backwards question, but
well, that's okay, David. I'm used to you asking backwards. Backwards questions, and I'll give a backwards answer.
Thank you.
No, the reality is the Seder is a retelling of the story of the Exodus from Egypt. The main purpose, the word Seder means telling, okay? Or actually, it doesn't mean telling. I'm sorry. They're going to revoke my rabbinical ordination. Seder means order. There is an order of a service which includes symbols from the time of going forth from Egypt and from later times. For example, we have a shank bone on the Seder plate, which is one of the on which we have all the symbols of Passover. And that shank bone is symbolic not of the time of going forth from Egypt, but of the Passover sacrifice that later came into Judaism, the actual physical sacrifices. We at Passover, we would sacrifice a lamb. So that's, those are all the symbols. So Seder means order. And the reason for the Seder is educational. It's a retelling every year of the going forth from Egypt. Now, what we've added to it and what we have included in it as years have passed are everything that is related of going forth from slavery to freedom. And slavery does not mean just a physical slavery, but it can be any type of allegorical or metaphorical slavery. We include readings for that also.
Okay, so what is the main lesson of Passover?
Freedom. Period. If you ask me to describe the main lesson of Passover in one word, it's freedom. Freedom from persecution, freedom from our own ideas which inhibit us, freedom in the broadest sense of the word.
I want to get back to that in a second. There are some very strict traditions of what you eat, like the matzah.
Right.
Yum.
Yum. Oh, yeah. I should have brought some today, but the problem is if I'd eat some, then I wouldn't be able to talk any because it's so dry. In Exodus, there is a passage that as the people were leaving Egypt, they didn't have time to actually bake bread. So they poured some flour and water on rocks, and it created this substance called matzah. And we are commanded to eat it during the entire Passover holiday. We are also told that we should not eat anything that mitzvah, that commandment, extends to eating anything that is leavened.
So no donuts.
Don't even mention it, Patty, please.
No cake,
oh, sorry,
no
nothing. Sorry.
No cake, no nothing, no donuts.
So as the Jews were leaving, they cut these matzahs into squares, put them into Manischewitz boxes, carried them on their head, and on top of that, square bottles of wine.
Right, exactly. They cut the matzah into precise squares. Mm-hmm. They had to be exactly 8 inches by 8 inches, mm-hmm. or whatever the dimension was at that time. They didn't have inches yet. They had what, David?
Dunams.
Dunams. Yeah. Whatever. I don't know dunam. Anyway.
So because of that, we then took the matzah and crumpled it up. And even though we didn't have time to let the bread rise, we had plenty of time to make the matzo balls, mix it with a little bit of eggs, refrigerate it for 15 minutes, and dump it into a pot of boiling broth.
Right, and then make this delicacy. Now, the problem with matzo balls is that matzo balls require a very exact time in the refrigerator, in the boiling water, with the amount of eggs, with the amount of oil, and all that. If you don't, they become violent projectiles, which can be very hard. One is judged in their Jewish culinary skills by how soft we can make the matzo balls.
I thought it's one of the greatest sins in Judaism to make a hard matzo ball and serve it.
Oh, well, to serve
well,
it.
To serve it, that would be. I'm sure many people may
have made the bad matzo balls.
To serve it right. If it's too hard, we simply ship them to Israel and they use them as rockets.
Ah, I see. Where did the tradition of the gefilte fish come from?
Minnesota.
Yeah, it did. No. Gefilte fish is purely an Eastern European creation.
The other traditional Jewish food is kung pao chicken.
No, David, that's on Yom Kippur when people don't eat in their homes or synagogue.
Oh, okay. And you go out to the Chinese restaurant.
And you go out to the Chinese. No, that's on sorry. On I'm really getting everything mixed up. That's on Christmas Eve that we eat. Jews eat Chinese food on Christmas
so
Eve.
So is it okay to eat pork during Passover as long as it's wrapped in matzah?
Absolutely. You can have pork. I had an aunt who really did not understand Judaism that well at all. And my parents were visiting her. This is a true story, so help me. Lightning may strike me if it's not true. Better watch out for the studio and be ready to get out. But no, it really is a true story that they came to visit her, and she said, well, I've got some of the best pork chops ready for y'all. And my parents looked at her kind of askance because pork is not a traditional Jewish meal.
No.
And no, it isn't. And she said, but they're done with matzah meal. So
that must make it okay.
That made it perfectly okay, and my parents scraped the matzah meal off the top, and that's all they ate.
Why don't we take our break? We're talking to Rabbi Steve Fish from Congregation Beth El Bana. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink. We're talking Passover. We're going to get to the theme of Passover, which is freedom, and how that relates to these religious freedom laws that are going around the country right now. We'll be back with more right after this.
I'm Christina from the ONs,
and I listen to Lambda Weekly
on 89.3 KNON FM. See you there.
Yeah. And we're back with Lambda Weekly.
Oh, I already did.
I think you kind of did already. I think that went out over the air. It did not go out over. Okay.
Okay. Well, since we're discussing Passover, I wanted to discuss traditionally Passover Seders, the Seder meal, are held at homes. But in case of our congregation, Beth El Bina, the second night we have a community Seder. That is for all members of our congregation
and friends who
want to come observe the Passover together with their friends and with their congregational members. And this year we just had an exceptional Seder, first of all because it was led by me. and secondly, I'm not throwing in a plug because I'm not mentioning anything, but if you go to the corner of Campbell and Preston, it's really, really great food.
They really did a great job of catering the Seder.
They really did.
And you know what was fun about it also, since they're Jewish, they enjoyed participating in the Seder while they were serving too. So
that's,
you know,
that's
it was one of those.
That's exactly it. So thanks. No plug to Zorich. But, oh, I'm sorry.
the theme you said of the Seder is freedom.
Theme of the Seder, absolutely, is freedom.
And over the last few weeks, these religious freedom laws have been popping up in state legislatures. What happened in Indiana this week?
Indiana's been very interesting, to say the least. Yeah,
Indiana imploded this week.
Indiana did. And for many in the Final Four scramble, they're imploding too.
I'm sorry if you're we're sorry if you're a Kentucky fan. We really are.
Yeah, that was a sad thing. But in the state of Indiana, the legislature passed a bill that they say very erroneously was modeled exactly after the federal law of the same title, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993.
What does the federal law do? What's the
federal law it only applies because of a Supreme Court case. It only applies to the federal government. It can't apply to states. But in it, it says that the government cannot restrict anyone's religious beliefs. What they've done in Indiana is to say not only government, but they've defined person to include, as we know, corporations. So for-profit businesses and individuals can go to court and say that their religious beliefs have been substantially burdened by, for example, serving gay people in their store. Or their restaurant or whatever it might be. And that, so it's far beyond what just anything from government. It would allow parties to be individuals, corporations, against individuals, you know, shopping. So that's a vast difference, huge difference in scope. And people, I think, were lying on the other side when they said it was basically like the federal one.
Now, the way they got rid of the Oklahoma law 2 weeks ago was Emily Virgin, who is an Oklahoma City straight representative, she submitted an amendment to their religious freedom restoration bill that said anybody can discriminate, you just have to post it.
Who it is, who's applying.
Who it is, I won't serve black people, I won't serve gay people, whoever you won't serve, needs to be in your business, needs to be on your website, in your advertising, and that way nobody walks in by mistake, and there's no embarrassment there. And also, if my friends and relatives who wouldn't have been discriminated against didn't care to do business with them, well, they'd know too.
Yeah.
That bill got pulled that night.
Yes.
She was brilliant. That's
it
the
was.
Way you kill one of these bills. Now,
you have to post it. I think you should be able to post it up. And that's why they can't, you know, straggle in other things.
Right.
It's like, these are my beliefs. Let's write it down today. And then, you
and this
know.
This is who I will not serve. Now,
kind of reminiscent of the 60s and who would not be served.
Right.
Or
exactly.
And earlier than that, in the 50s, neighborhoods that says, you know, no blacks or Jews allowed.
Okay,
right.
So you've been oppressed.
Oh, I am very oppressed. I'm eating matzah for 8 days.
Where does – and this is the question that I think some right-wing Christians – don't understand. What's the difference between oppression and just minding your own business? Where's the difference? Where is the line between your freedom of religion and my freedom of religion? How do we balance those things?
Well, first of all, government has no business being at all involved in religion. If we have a strict separation of church and state, which we've never had, I mean, Thomas Jefferson wrote extensively on where religion and state should interact and intersect and should not intersect. But if we have a strict separation of church and state, then the state has no business of interfering in any religious activities whatsoever. And this law which was passed in Indiana, the laws that are proposed in several other states, really want to get politics in the middle of religion because they want to pass laws that are, although they call them religious freedom laws, that's like calling the Nuremberg laws Jewish freedom laws. I mean, that's as oppressive as they are. Perhaps I'm being a little bit exaggerating there, but at the same time, what they're doing is deliberately passing these laws so that they can further their own prejudices and further their own desires to not serve certain people.
Now, we have a bill going through the legislature right now. It's House Bill 2553 by Representative Molly White. If you don't know the name now, you will over the next few terms of hers because, God, is she a wacko.
We have so many, though.
No, you know, we do. I think she's going for the prize.
Okay.
I walked into her office with some people who were constituents of hers, and they were told, don't waste our time, or I don't want to waste your time, and better yet, you're not going to waste mine. Now get out of here. That's a quote. She's delightful. Anyway, her bill would allow business owners to decide whom they serve or conduct business with based on religious convictions. Okay, Steve, tell us, what's wrong with that?
Where do you start?
Where do you start? I mean, I turn the question around. What's right with that? I mean, it goes blatantly against the U.S. Constitution. It goes blatantly against the Civil Rights Act.
So are you saying if you're a business owner and somebody walks into your business, you should do business with them?
Absolutely.
If you hang your shingle out in the public marketplace, it's open to everybody.
Wow, I never thought of it that. So you're saying if you charge one person $10 for something, you should charge somebody else. But if you have more people coming in, you might make more money?
Oh, gee, what a novel principle.
Yeah. And what really chaps me about all of this is like with the pizzeria that
that was a fake. That was so phony.
Well, but the idea of it, though, that we would not serve a gay wedding, for example, or the other establishments that said that they would not serve gay
people. Everybody doesn't know what you're talking about. What is this pizzeria? It was in Indiana.
It was Memories Pizza, and I guess it is Memories because it's –
They closed.
They closed. they saved due to threats and such, but – the right wing's raising the money, so I guess they retired.
They raised $500,000 for these people in one day.
Yep.
I'm in the wrong business.
Apparently.
A TV station in Indiana went,
South Bend.
Basically soliciting, how do you feel about this law? Do you think you'd run your business under it? Blah, blah, blah. And they finally found somebody that would say, well, we're not going to do a gay wedding. Well, they don't do any catering at all. Mm-hmm. It just reminds me of the governor of Jam Brewer saying, well, I'm not going to run for another term. Well, no, you're prohibited by the state constitution of Arizona. You can't run for a third term. But they never did it.
Pizza place, all she was doing was just spouting what she'd heard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she heard, we're all going to be forced to serve gay weddings. Well, you know something?
And if I saw it once, I saw it 10,000 times. What self-respecting gay person has pizza?
Well, I guess there's some gay rednecks from Italy who serve pizza at their weddings.
Well,
tradition. That's right. It's a big tradition.
Brian and I were planning on pizza, but we've switched to McDonald's now.
Oh, there you go. Aaron and I were saying, well, it would be very hoity-toity stuff and a la minute. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you would make your little pizza. They would make it for you to order, you know, right there at the wedding reception. Maybe that.
But what she was really doing, she was just spouting that garbage that she heard in the media, especially from right-wing Fox and that kind of garbage. That
Fox is right-wing?
No, they're right-wing garbage.
Oh, okay.
There's a difference.
Okay.
And you can be conservative. There are two sides to every story at least. But there's a difference between conservative and right-wing garbage that's just spouting lies for the purpose of inciting bigotry. And that's what this has done. Oh, they're going to force me to cater gay weddings. You know what? In your little town of 1,500 people, if a gay couple came in, you probably know them already.
Right. Well, and what's crazy is they asked one business who said that they wouldn't cater a wedding, and if you would then deny service to people who are adulterers, people who divorce, mm-hmm. people who all these other things. She says, no, we would serve them. And they said, well, what's the difference?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, there's a big difference in sins, those sins.
There is. Adultery is one of the Ten Commandments. Being gay is not.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, what number
so
is?
So that's the difference.
Must be.
That's
but for our listeners who haven't been paying attention to the news, Indiana fixed their bill.
And did they really fix it? I didn't read what it was that the fix was.
This is the fix that went into the bill, to the amended bill. It states, the changes prohibit businesses from using the law as a defense in court for refusing, quote, to offer or provide services, facilities, use of public accommodations, goods, employment, or housing to any customers based on, quote, race, color, religion, ancestry, age, national origin, disability, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, or United States military service.
Hmm. You know, so, they didn't include the length of one's forefinger.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, that sounds pretty inclusive.
Or the length of somebody's middle finger.
Right.
You were thinking that. I was thinking it too, David, but I'm a rabbi. I don't.
You can't say that. See? Happy to be there for you. Okay, so.
So we actually got more protections into the bill.
Than we had before.
Than we had before, yes.
Right.
It's the first time they've ever, sexual orientation, gender identity have ever been mentioned in Indiana law.
Right. And we applaud the governor of Arkansas who refused to sign their religious freedom law.
Under pressure. Under pressure. He had announced a couple of days before he was going to sign it.
And here's the big deal in Arkansas is that, you know, they've been touting that the Indiana law and the Arkansas law were so basically the federal law,
mm-hmm.
you know, exactly like the federal law. Well, with the revamp that came in Arkansas was to bring it to be exactly like mm-hmm. the federal law. So it couldn't have been the same before.
Mm-hmm.
And then
if you're changing it.
Yeah. So.
Okay, so. But we do believe in religious freedom, and we don't believe in infringing on somebody's religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So where does my religious belief end and yours begin? Because obviously to some people, discriminating against gay people they think is part of their religious belief, mm-hmm. and other people are gay. So where does that end?
Oh, and don't mention that, you know, people who divorce or who are adulterers or whatever, they're off the hook. They're really not part of their religious
belief. Do I have a right to discriminate against somebody who's divorced because I don't believe in divorce? Do I?
No.
Okay.
I mean, but this is not a laws of the country, of our country, have always been reflective of societal attitudes. If you go back to before 1865, the law of the land was slavery was allowed. If you go back before 19, when was Brown versus Board of Education?
53.
53. Anyway, if you go back before Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, it was okay to have inferior schools that were labeled separate but equal, and we know they weren't equal. So truly, the laws of the land, they are always of our land. We've built in safeguards so that laws can be changing, indicative of the times. And, you know, thank God, if this law were passed, this Indiana law, if anybody had thought to pass it in 1960, there probably wouldn't have been any uproar because gay rights, I mean, we were just entering into the period of civil rights for African Americans. But now at this time, when the rights of every person, whether gay, whether straight, no matter what, are assumed to be equal to every other, that all rights are equal, finally, that all men and women are created equal, that finally the laws are indicative of that, and the laws are being written and rejected based on that criteria,
criteria. I'm looking for what is the answer to somebody who says, well, now I have to serve gay people, and that goes against my religion.
Suck it up. You know, butch up.
Is the answer your religious rights end where my religious rights
begin?
Right.
And if you're a business and you're holding out your shingle to the general public, you cannot turn people away based upon your decision of who you don't accept.
You know, and I'm being a devil's advocate when I'm asking this question. I did a story about 2-3 months ago about somebody who grew up in a small town in Arkansas. He passed away, and his partner called the church that he grew up in Arkansas. Would he do the funeral? And the pastor just told him absolutely not. Now, he had any pastor has a right not to do any religious service he doesn't want to do, and I'm not saying he should have. If somebody called you and it was not a service you felt comfortable doing, would you take 2 minutes to refer him to somebody else?
Yeah, I'm sure I would. Well, first of all, a service that I would not feel comfortable – the only service with which you've got me thinking, so I'm stuttering here a little bit. The only service which I would refuse to conduct would be one of a person who says, I don't like people. Now, people can be Jews, they can be gays, they can be African American. If someone came to me and said, would you do a service in which you espouse these beliefs, which are alien to my religion, I would not do it. So I suppose that if Fred Phelps Jr. was asked to do a service and he didn't feel comfortable with doing that, he has the right not to do it. But again, it's not because of political reasons. It's because of religious reasons.
But here is my point with that. Somebody's calling you, their partner just died. Instead of just refusing, wouldn't you help them find somebody who can help them?
Oh, absolutely. And this does occur with me sometimes because I have certain conditions. I do intermarriages of Jews and non-Jews.
But there some rabbis don't.
Yeah, and some rabbis don't, and that's fine, and they call me sometimes. Uh-huh. There are certain Jewish funeral traditions which Orthodox rabbis insist upon, which I as a Reform rabbi do not insist upon, and the one of the Orthodox rabbis in town, who is a chaplain to the whole Jewish community, will regularly call me and say, are you available, because he already knows that I'm willing, to do this funeral in which Orthodox customs are not followed. And I say, sure, because it's a mitzvah. It's a commandment. A commandment and a good deed. That's the definition of mitzvah, those two put together, to help those who are grieving.
My point with this case was, why are you a pastor? If you couldn't take 2 minutes, there are five churches in this town, and you couldn't give this guy who's grieving, obviously, and it's somebody that you baptized as a child, you couldn't give him the name of a number of another pastor. I thought that was,
well, and
wow.
What's really, I think, really...
I think it's bigoted.
It's hugely bigoted.
And of course it is. But if that's his calling for being as a pastor, wow.
And what really irritates me from an LGBT perspective is when people in the fright wing, I call them, those fright wing extremists, you know, talk about, well, you know, with allowing gay couples to get married, it's going to cause, you know, they're going to be forced. We're going to be forced to do things in our religion that we're not, or they'll sue us or whatever. And I just think that's so stupid. It's not going to happen. It's not happened. You know, I mean, like, Catholic priests don't always conduct a marriage wedding service for two people who are not both Catholic, or for someone who's been divorced. You know, and it goes on and on from religion to religion, and nobody's been forced by the government to conduct any sort of
marriage.
Yeah, exactly.
You've turned down marriage.
And that's not going to change because gay people get married.
Right. Absolutely. And what I've said is that nobody has the right to come into my synagogue and to tell me, based on a government law, based on government, that I should or should not marry anyone, any more than I should go into a Catholic church and say, Father, this is not the way you should conduct communion. That is a religious right, and it's where I think we get confused in the United States is when we get to politics confused with religion. And I think that what has happened over the last few years that I have seen are the right-wing evangelicals have used religion to promulgate their viewpoint while trying to deny those of other religions, using their religious viewpoint to state what they feel is right. And I have always said, and I said this in my first ever sermon at Beth El Bina, is that I have my own beliefs. I will definitely have my own beliefs. And what I will say is, yes, what I'm doing is right. But then I add two words, for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as long as anyone, any religion, does that, says what I'm doing is right for me, and, of course, what they do is ethically and morally not only responsible, but correct, and I think we can agree on that, then I have every bit of respect for their religion. I mean, I'm not going to take communion, but, you know, for me to ask a Catholic not to take communion?
Yeah, it's their truth.
Exactly.
And let's take a break.
And that's really crazy, too, about – we should start it with, I believe, instead of declaring these things as facts and truth.
Right. We need to take a break. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late heathen Patty Fink, and Rabbi Steve Fish is our guest today. We'll be back with more right after this.
This is William. I download Lambda Weekly podcast from LambdaWeekly.com.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink, operating the board. As always, are Chris and Josh Manis. Doc is here doing our video podcast. Those are usually up online for you to watch, two or three days after the show. And our guest today.
David's choking up. Yeah, he's all choked up.
Our guest, David, I'm so honored that you get choked up at even thinking about or mentioning my name. I am so honored.
Our guest today is Rabbi Steve Fish from Congregation Beth El Bina. We were talking a little bit about the religious freedom laws, and those have everything to do with the fear that same-sex marriage is approaching. It's going to happen when the Supreme Court first hears the case at the end of April and then rules on it at the end of June. And some things could happen that doesn't happen, but that's what we're expecting. The argument by a lot of religious people, especially the ones that get on most talk shows that you hear, is same-sex marriage is against everybody's religion, and you would think it would be. What's the Jewish belief on same-sex marriage?
Okay. The Jewish belief on same-sex marriage I think, has been stated most eloquently, not by a Reform rabbi, not by a conservative rabbi, but and not even by an Orthodox rabbi, but by a Hasidic rabbi. His name is Shmuley Boteach, and he has been roundly criticized by members of the Orthodox community. He says, yes, in Leviticus there is one sentence that goes against homosexuality. And it's pretty clear, although you can look at it and say, well, it couldn't be clearer because the law states you can't have sex with a man in the same way that you can have sex with a woman. Obviously, men don't have the vaginal opening, so there's no way possible. But what they're referring is to, of course, intercourse in a different manner. But what Rabbi Boteach says so eloquently is in the Jewish tradition, there are 613 commandments that are stated in the Torah, in the five books of Moses. That's one of them. When you have observed completely the other 612, then come to me and say, okay, I don't want anyone not observing that one law. And to me, that is, it's ironic because the rabbinical body of Hasidic Judaism or Orthodox Judaism, none of these have come forward in favor of same-sex marriage. The rabbinical bodies of Reform and Conservative Judaism have
come in favor of and Reconstructionists.
And Reconstructionists, right. The more liberal Jewish bodies have come forward in favor of same-sex marriage. But the most eloquent message is from an Orthodox Jew.
Mm-hmm. And the same, I think, in the Christian faith, in the Protestant faith, and even in many, many Roman Catholics, tens of millions of Americans who self-identify as Christian support marriage equality, mm-hmm. and equality for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in this country. Mm-hmm. And so when the right-wingers say, how can you be Christian and support gay people? Well, it's a very natural thing for many, many denominations of Protestantism and millions of Roman Catholics in this country. So they don't have a lock on the word Christian. They just don't. They want to, but they don't.
Orthodox doesn't have a position really on it. They haven't voted against it. They won't do it, mostly.
Well, for the most part, an Orthodox rabbi won't do it. And secondly, the Orthodox Judaism states that you should observe all 613 of those commandments, plus thousands of others that are stated in the Talmud, a later book of law of Judaism. And so, yes, they would say I can't speak for all of my Orthodox colleagues, mm-hmm. And each Jew has their own opinion and each rabbi. But in Orthodox Judaism, the rabbis are constrained by the laws of the Torah, so I would doubt very seriously that any of my Orthodox colleagues would conduct a same-sex wedding.
Okay, so what if you're a Reform rabbi and just don't happen to believe in same-sex marriage?
If you're a Reform rabbi, you are free to do what your conscience says. Reform stresses autonomy among every rabbi. And although all of the major institutions of Reform Judaism, or I should say both of them, the Central Conference of American Rabbis and the Union for Reform Judaism, have made strong statements in favor of complete equality for the LGBT population, including marriage and including rabbinic ordination in the Reform and Conservative and Reconstructionist movement for the LGBT population.
The new head of the Central Conference of American
Rabbis. Right, and the new head of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, Rabbi Denise Egger, is a lesbian and was denied the right to come out of the closet for many years and suffered discrimination in her job placement for many years. But she's now president of the rabbinical body of Reform Judaism.
That's quite a statement itself.
Same thing going on in the Baptist Church, Patty?
No. In fact, I would be, far be it for not only a lesbian, but just a mere woman to be leading the Southern Baptist Convention in any way, shape, or form.
I thought there was a lesbian in the head of Southern Baptist Convention. No.
No, not so you notice.
Oh,
no.
Okay. I'm just wondering.
Okay, she's still in the closet, but she thinks she's head of the Southern Baptist. I shouldn't say that. As a Jew, I'm not allowed to say that. But in reality, you know, you ask the question, would a Reform rabbi be free to perform that wedding or not perform that wedding? Absolutely.
Okay, so here's one of my questions with these religious freedom laws. And actually, there was a lawsuit filed in North Carolina that has gotten nowhere, that has not gotten a hearing, by Reform Judaism, by United Church of Christ, and several, I think, Unitarians joined the suit, and that suit is saying, you are infringing on my religious right as a rabbi to not let me perform a legal wedding, whereas all of these other religions are saying it's infringing for you to do that wedding.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I come forward with the same statement I just made a few minutes ago, and I'll make it until I'm 6 feet under. And if I'm talking when I'm 6 feet under, which some rabbis do, but you know, but until my dying day, I will say that marriage is a religious proposition, period. Now, unfortunately or fortunately, because of the civil nature of property rights, it has to be, there has to be a political, not a political, but a legal aspect to it. But that legal aspect doesn't have to infringe on anybody's religious rights. So I think very strongly that the freedom of who we should marry, when we should marry, where we should marry, would be an individual and a religious decision to be decided within that religious body.
So it is something that should be decided within your own religion. But again, here's where I'm asking, where does your religious discrimination or your religious beliefs start infringing on mine? Where do mine infringe on yours? If you don't believe in same-sex marriage, and I do, aren't you infringing by stopping me in my synagogue?
Well, and why wouldn't I also stop people who can't procreate, since apparently, and according to them, you know, procreation is the sole purpose of marriage. You know, so older people and people who choose not to have children or who can't, you know, should not be married either.
Okay, well, let's go to that definition, because the state of Texas argued in the Fifth Circuit, Louisiana made absolutely moronic arguments in the Fifth Circuit.
That's in Texas, by the way.
Well, Texas was, yes. By the time it got to Texas, I think the judges were so frustrated that
the absurdity upon absurdity was
so
crazy.
Right.
So what is the definition of marriage then? It's not solely for procreation.
No, marriage is not solely for procreation. Marriage is a union between two people who love, respect, care for each other, and want to spend their time in this sacred relationship. The term for marriage in Judaism is kiddushin. And for those listeners who are Jewish, you know of the word, the root word kiddush, which means holiness. But it means more than that. It means set apart. It means that this is a relationship that is like, that is set apart from any other relationship. And it's set apart by the definition of marital fidelity. Mm-hmm. And therefore, in Judaism, kiddushin may be any two people, okay, who wish to spend their time with each other. I'm not going to say spend their lives with each other, because we do understand that sometimes marriages don't work and divorce is a necessary evil. Mm-hmm. But we don't define marriage based on procreation, based upon the sex of the participants.
The idea that marriage has not changed since biblical times, which is one of the arguments that they use, again, it's idiotic.
Absolutely. In my opinion, it's idiotic. Marriage has changed with each generation. You know, the definition of family has changed with generations. In the early 20th century, it was very common for one person of the family, usually the father, to come to America, and the children and the wife would, in many cases, stay behind until the father could send money back. That didn't mean that couple was not still married. So for anybody to say that the definition of marriage has not changed since biblical times is wrong, in my opinion.
So it would not be okay for me to have a couple of concubines?
Go ahead, David.
Okay.
You know, that's fine. You can have a couple of gay concubines. Huh. And as
Patty
long
and Aaron?
Yeah.
Oh, we don't want concubines. Thank you.
Okay. No, but I mean, the difficulty with that is, and this is where we come up against the legal, and it's a line that is not sharply delineated. But the United States declared long ago that polygamy is not legal here.
You know, and of course, I'm kidding. But when you say that it's changed every generation, my grandfather had a story that he told about in his hometown where it was an arranged marriage that he went to, and the woman arrived in veils that were just very, very heavy. And when the veils came off, it was a different person than he was promised, but they were already married.
So. Right. Well, that goes all the way back. That's a biblical tradition, Jacob and Leah and Rachel.
But when we say marriage hasn't changed since biblical times, could we imagine that happening today? Well, this is my grandfather's generation, even.
Right.
So it does change every generation.
It does change every generation. It changes within generations.
A generation ago, women who were married couldn't own property.
Right.
1964 was the change.
In Texas.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Can you imagine that today?
The magnificent late Louise Raggio was the instigator of that change that actually codified a family law for the first time in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because married women in Texas couldn't have a bank account, couldn't own land.
Mm.
In Texas, in 1964. Some of us were even born before then.
Mm.
Shocker.
Yeah, Doc.
What did I
no, nothing, Doc. We were just commenting how old you were. So marriage means all kinds of other things that it didn't mean years ago.
Right. Well, you know, I'm going to, and God forgive me for this, but I'm going to allude to a popular program on TV known as Grey's Anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And if you're an aficionado of Grey's Anatomy, two of the principal characters have their marriage on a post-it note. What they decided several years ago in the series was simply, and the writers I thought were brilliant, is the fact that they wrote what marriage meant to them. They put it on a post-it note. It's over their bed. And that's what it means to them. I mean, so I don't know what it would mean in terms of legal property rights and all that. But that was their definition of marriage. And as far as I'm concerned, the definition of marriage for me, yes, there is a legal requirement in terms of property rights and in terms of legal rights. But marriage for me is kiddushin. It's two people who pledge themselves to each other that their relationship will be unlike any other relationship they have with any other person.
So you're saying the same thing that we've been saying, that there's a difference, you know, and we've been saying this for years, there's a difference between legal marriage and religious marriage, that the religious marriage, you're defining it a number of ways, the relationship, the respect, the caring for each other, as well as, in many cases, having children. But the legal part of marriage is the property rights, the legal rights, all those other things that that the marriage license itself gives you.
You can't testify against your spouse.
No.
You know, which is the big one that Aaron and I are looking for. Yeah.
Especially when you're really pissed off at each other.
Right.
Now, you know, one other thing, though. At the beginning of the show, you said you had a visit from a Jehovah's Witness.
I did, and okay. I feel so badly about it.
Okay.
On Friday.
Tell quickly what happened, because I want to go off on that for a second.
I work from home, so I was greeted by a Jehovah's Witness who had literature and was asking me to offering a attendance at a service they were offering, and I declined and such. And it was on Friday, on Good Friday. And as she was leaving, I yelled, "Happy Easter," as I was closing the door.
Just to be nice, you said that. You were not saying
yes.
I said
it nicely.
Oops.
You know. And I realized, oh no, they don't celebrate holidays. They don't even celebrate birthdays.
Okay, so when we're talking about one person's religion interfering with another person's religion, that person has a right to knock on your door to proselytize.
Mm-hmm.
You had the right to say no thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Or you had the right, I guess, to just slam the door. But I mean,
I yelled Happy Easter. She did leave the gate wide open, though.
There's nothing wrong with being polite, though, so you just said no thank you. So did doesn't that person's religious right end at your door?
It does, indeed.
Of course. Say that's a great way to put it.
I need not invite her in because it's my home.
Yeah, that's right. You know, if a person came to my door, as they have in the past, mm-hmm. with evangelical materials, I simply say, thank you. That's not my belief. I respect yours. And, have a good day.
Mm-hmm.
Girl Scouts with cookies are a different story. That's part of my religion. The cookies. Not the Girl Scouts. I want the cookies to be great.
But I think that's a great way to leave it. We're just about out of time. Rabbi Steve Fish, I want to thank you for being here. Have a happy rest of your Passover.
Thank you. But I love that analogy, David. It ends at my door.
Mm-hmm. And, Patty, have a very nice Easter.
Thank you.
If you're going back downtown to First Baptist, say hi to Pastor Jeffers
for us.
Tell him that we would love to have him on the show sometime. And for all of us here at Lambda Weekly, we'll see you next week.